When we speak to our guest today, who is the ArtNet writer and auction house salesperson in a way, he's hosting gallery shows at the auction house. There's a series called The Hoarder that I want to talk to him about. Kenny Schachter. Kenny's in from New York, although he lived in London. He is a New Yorker, and he's here. We have special permission to have him in a COVID-restricted way, and he's going to talk to us about all the things that he knows are going on in the art world, both in New York and here. Last time we spoke to Kenny, Koresh and I talked to him about the Ineo Philbrook scandal. Ineo had just been arrested. Then we talked to him with Jake Chapman. The first time he was on the show was over 2 years ago. He was on one of my first shows. And the last time he was in the studio, because he's done some remotes from New York, was in February 2019. Hard to believe. So there's a lot of ground to cover. And I am overexcited, really, about having someone as informative and insightful in the studio. And I'm excited because for years and decades, the art world was all about the conversations you had and the ideas that were sparked when you had those conversations. So this moment and this opportunity to grab a conversation with someone who carries around with them so much insight and experience and knowledge and practice in the art world is something I'm really looking forward to. I hope you are too. I'm going to play Kenny's first choice in music, which is called
The Good Thing
by the Talking Heads. I'm sure he's picked that for a reason. And we'll be back right after.
Fight with understanding.
The Good Thing by the Talking Heads. That's one of Kenny Schachter's choices. Kenny will be here with us today in a few minutes, we're hoping. Who knows with traffic? It's a nightmare getting around the city, even though you would think it's isolated. It's not. The week that was the art world, which I found went by really quickly. Did you, Koresh? How did we get to be Friday? I know everyone's saying it, but time really is moving at a different rate. I don't know. I feel like I woke up and it was Monday morning and now it's Friday. But maybe that's the idea of a studio practice. Maybe providing we're all healthy and we have work to do, this uninterrupted flow of ideas that is a studio practice is kind of the only way I can approach lockdown without going crazy. Being in the world, but not with the world, because that's what artists do, whether they're writers or musicians or painters or sculptors. They're part of the world, but they separate themselves from the world. And if there is something to be learned from the artist practice, this moment in lockdown may give you insight into that. The classic practice was always just one step outside of what society's doing as an observer, which is why often the spouses of artists are always kind of objective about the marital experience. They're very clear that the first relationship for the artist is the relationship with their practice, with the art world, rather than with the person they're married to, whether that's Terrence Donovan's wife, Diana Donovan, or when we talk to Mimi Thompson, who is married to Jim Rosenquist, the women love them, but they realize that their practice was another life for the artists. So it'll be interesting to see what comes out of all of this. One of the things that people are saying these days is there's nothing to do. And as a result of that comment, I have been going through decades of art history and everything that's available online to find cultural things to do. Now, museums and galleries have had to keep their program going because I think, much to most of our surprise, this new approach to doing business is staying around for a lot longer than we realize. You know, art fairs have been decimated and people are creating artist talks online. They're creating platforms for viewing rooms online. They're doing things with the art world online. So oftentimes you sign in, you join a group, and you can have a curated talk through an exhibition, or you can become sometimes paid for, sometimes not, part of a program that the Barbican, the Tate, the Royal Academy are hosting in the way that they would host it if people were leaving their houses and going to their buildings. So Marina Abramovic, or guided tours through the Andy Warhol, the Zanelli Moholy, things that are in the museums but not available to us at the moment. And I came across, well, actually, I didn't come across it. My friend Abby Hignall, who runs Hignall Gallery, which specializes in post-war sculpture or modernist sculpture. I'm sure I'm saying it wrong and Abby would correct me, but that's what I rely on her for because she is a specialist. Phoned me and said, you've got to see Pretend It's a City. And I haven't learned. It's sort of like a child learning how to be around alcohol. I haven't learned how to be around Netflix. So if I turn on a Netflix program and I like it, I can't moderate the way I watch it. So it's not something I enjoy. I did enjoy this, but it did exhaust me. Pretend It's a City is, I think, a 7 or 8 part series with Martin Scorsese and Fran Lebowitz. Fran Lebowitz started in New York in 1970. She worked for Interview magazine, was with Andy Warhol, although they did not like each other, which kind of resulted in some interesting tensions. Tensions are good, and there was a time when people celebrated tension and debate and disagreement as a way of moving culture forward. I'm not sure we're there right now. Everyone may be a bit sensitive, but things, that's not a judgment. That's the way things ebb and flow. It'll always be like that. So Pretend It's a City is a series of conversations in front of a studio audience between Fran Lebowitz and Martin Scorsese. And Fran has some great one-liners. One of her one-liners is how would you describe, she answers a question to someone in the audience, how would you describe her lifestyle? And her answer is, well, I can assure you, I'd never use the word lifestyle. Then other notions in the way people think, talking about expensive cities to live in, whether that's New York or Hong Kong or London. People who don't live in the cities always say, how can you afford to live in New York? How can you afford to live in London? And Fran summed it up in a way that's so true by saying, no one can afford to live in New York, yet 8 million people do. How do we do it? We don't know. It was really uplifting, but intelligent. And she did say that she and Andy didn't get along. And his last joke on her was a week before he died, she had to sell her collection of Andy Warhols to pay something in terms of her rent. And of course, they were less expensive. I know. It's very, 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 very witty and very fun. It's called Pretend It's a City. It's on Netflix. I suggest you have a look at it. I learned a lot about the New York Dolls, about books, about artists that she had relationships with, about the nature of parties and the purpose of parties, about working for interview, about humor, about sexuality. Fran is a lesbian, and going to New York was really the only option when Fran was growing up, and she went there and met everyone. She famously doesn't have a cell phone or a computer. It's almost her reason for being to show people that you can get through life without those things. I'm going to play another song from you from Kenny's playlist. And that song is, I'm looking for him because I'm wondering if he got delayed. Well, clearly he got delayed. We should hear from him soon. But the next song is
Don't Delete the Kisses
by
Wolf Alice
for Kenny Schachter.
Thank you.
for Kenny Schachter. He's not here yet, but I'm not surprised. It's a nightmare getting around. Did you hear last night that the Tintin comic book broke auction house records by selling for $3.1 million? Do you remember Tintin by the Belgian artist Hergé? Well, last night it sold at a Paris auction for 2.6 million euros. That's $3.1 million, and I'll have to do currency converter to find out what it is in pounds, but it's a lot of money. Breaking the record for the most expensive comic book in history. Now, if you listen to the show, you won't be surprised when I say, what's going on here? Are we creating a new market? What's happening? I'd like to know more about this. I looked at the piece. It's an ink and water painted original panel of the comic book character Tintin from 1936. The drawing, of course, and I'm repeating myself, is by the Belgian artist Hergé, and it sold on Thursday for the amount I said, 3.1 million, breaking records for comics. What's going on? We know that the auction houses aren't getting as much material. I knew you'd miss him. I know, I'm like, Karish, keep an eye out for Kenny. That's why I went broke. I missed it for a minute. And Kenny is here, which is really a great thing. I'm so happy to see him. Anyway, what I want Kenny to do is tell us what's going on with the auction houses. And he's here. He's getting seated. We're happy to see him. He's here. We've been playing Wolf Alice for you. Don't be sorry at all. Koresh, who you haven't met before, is going to seat you. And I'm talking about the Tintin sale last night while you got here. A big comic book that went for a fortune, which makes me think that the auction houses are up to something. And I knew you would know about that. Are they creating a new market for sales?
Give me a second.
Hervé, Kenny's getting his stuff together.
So that we can film this.
Can you hear this? This is about as exciting as it's been in the studio for the past year. We had special. No, I'd ask Koresh to watch you walk back and forth. Blame him. He's like, yeah, I got it. And I see you going back and forth. Thank you. But this excitement is something none of us have had. So Kenny's here. He's done the hoarder. He's flown around town. He hasn't been live in the studio since 2019, February. I've asked. You've done remotes with
us. No, not 19. Yes, 19. 2 years ago.
2 years ago. But this year didn't count because it just flew by in some sort of weird state of being. Now, for anyone who's wondering, Kenny's had all of his tests. He's probably had more corona tests than anyone
18.
We know.
I have antibodies.
18.
And I'm PCR tested.
What's PCR tested?
There's two different. I've become a corona expert, unfortunately. There's an antigen test.
Yes.
Which is the quickest test.
Yes.
But it's less sensitive.
Yes.
Than the PCR test. And the PCR test is the one that is definitive.
And you're fine, is all I need to know.
Well, I'm as fine as I ever was. I'm not sure that's entirely
correct.
Perfect.
I get that. I get
still that. Have no sense of smell.
I am so happy to see you, and I've been reading your articles to kind of get some of what we're missing in the art world as it used to happen. And you just did a recent hoarder in New York with
yes,
your collection.
I mean,
now, I've got to put this to you like this, because I've known of you and about you for a long time. This year, when we weren't in lockdown, I was at the Banksy auction for Show Me the Money. There was like six of us there. And
oh, really?
I knew. Yeah, it was amazing. And you know everyone who's in the room. And then everything was online. So there's this idea that things are happening with the art world in galleries that's quite strong. And then the next thing you know, you, who's had a gallery, who's been an artist.
Never had a gallery.
Who's worked.
Not a professional one. Go ahead, carry on.
Now you're hosting exhibits, which are also selling spaces without a reserve. So technically, you're the only place in an auction house that can get a bargain anymore because you don't put reserves.
Expense. I lost a bloody fortune.
Only because
my
you
loss
can afford
is your gain.
To.
Did you buy anything from the sale?
No, no, I did not.
What can I tell you?
Because I still like getting gifted.
A gift? Oh, there's a quid pro quo.
Kenny, let's talk about you and how you've evolved with the art world, because I'm guessing that lockdown hasn't stopped you. But the art, the last time you were here, you were talking about the problem with art fairs, with the problem with private museums, the problem with people like Ineo Philbrook. Where are we at now that everything is online?
You're mentioning a lot of problems.
Because they're interesting and you make them interesting.
Well, in a sense, nothing can ever stop the art world. The art world, I say, is like taking a poop. It's part of human nature, the human inclination to create and to people to express themselves differentiates us from other species. I'm not perfect. I have a lot of problems. And the world today is rife with problems, especially the corona disease has it more of a human toll, a catastrophe of taking more lives today in the United States, UK, and various other places than ever. And at the same time, nothing could stop art, because art is like going to the bathroom and eating and sleeping. It's part of the creative expression of individuality or a collective sensibility of what's affecting us or afflicting us. It's just part of life. So in a sense, I mean, again, like, I haven't lost anybody to the disease, and I did suffer from it in October, and luckily, knock on, do you have any wood around here? Everything looks pretty formica plastic, but nothing will stop me, because I have one life to live, and I just want to, I taught all throughout the period that I had COVID. I did a series of online talks. I was teaching at the School of Visual Arts and writing, but really art reacts to social, political, and economic phenomena in the world. So the art world, there'll be so much extraordinary art that emanates from the unrest politically, socially, health-wise. So probably this has been an incredible period. Last time I was here, we spoke about, I mean, there was, in the year 2000, there were 50 art fairs. Last year, I mean, the last art fair I went to, there were two. One was in February, which was in Los Angeles, that I curated a room in with my family and with some various artists that I was interested in. Then there was the Armory in March, and then everything came to a grinding halt. And again, aside from the human tragedy, which is with us to a greater extent today than ever before, it's almost as if, I mean, I don't believe in fate or determinism per se, but this has been an extraordinary period of people taking stock of what's important and prioritizing family, caring for loved ones, and also art for the sake of art. I mean, I always say that I never get to talk about art because I'm professionally involved in the art world and nobody gives a shit about art. They just want to talk about money, who's showing where, who's showing. You mentioned auctions, and it's all a kind of monetization of creative output, which has been deadening and really kind of awful. So in a sense, this period of contemplation and everyone retreating and taking stock and pulling back, during the first 3 months of quarantine, I was in New York City, and I was teaching at School of Visual Arts. I did interviews with artists like from here, like from Jake Chapman and Tracy Emin, which was an extraordinary experience and very touching and revelatory. And at the same time, I mean, yeah, so from every bad event that befalls us, there's always good to come from it, because humanity, I mean, look, in America right now, it's a shocking period, historically speaking, politically. Everyone is suffering, like here, economically, although New York is wide open. Other than restaurants, you can still eat outdoors. Galleries are open. Museums are open. Stores are open. So even though, again, the death toll is the highest it's ever been in the United States, and unfortunately the death toll from political protests, which was absolutely unprecedented, it's all rather shocking. But again, it's just, that's life, you know?
I thought it was a meme when I first saw it. I saw it on Jake's first. And I'm like, oh, he's found some sort of crazy meme. And
the most
then I checked the news.
Is like, it's like a selfie revolution. I mean, these idiots, there's no other way. I mean, I could describe them in other words, but I'm not sure what your censorship issue is with
We're
my
okay
dirty
here.
Language.
We're okay here. It's
but
the BBC.
What a fucking
weird.
Bunch of morons.
There we go.
I mean, they broke into the... Basically, when the World Trade Center went down, there were a ton of people jumped out of the World Trade Center from desperation due to the fact that it was a light on fire and there was no way out. And people just out of pure, utter exasperation jumped. None of that was depicted or represented in the press in America. It wasn't in the newspapers. It wasn't on the news, on television.
There was no Instagram.
Right. So what they didn't show in the Capitol was the extent of the pure violence. I mean, the policeman that died had a fire extinguisher thrown at his skull, and that's how he perished. But the fact is, these knuckleheads were just like taking selfies of themselves in these ludicrous costumes that you just couldn't make up. That's why I have a hard time reading fiction, because the things we do to each other is so dreadful. But again, like, I mean, the last time I don't know, there's so many different things that are flying through my head.
I know. How long are you here for in London?
I think I'll be here till the 25th of January, and I'm working on an exhibition that just got, again, postponed till I was meant to do an exhibition in Switzerland, a group exhibition with my family and a group of artists that I'm interested in. And that was meant to be in the middle of February, and it's now been moved to the end of March. So I'm probably here. I've been here for near a week, and I'll be here for another week.
Well, you're welcome to come back. You just let me know, because we can put together some sort of podcast just with all of your thoughts and ideas about what's going on.
I appreciate what you do and how you do it, so I'm here at your service.
So the thoughts flying around in your head.
Well, I mean, there's been great things that have happened to me over the last 2 years. I mean, I have to say, like, aside from being sick myself, I had chronic excruciating headaches for between 2 and 3 months. And after getting tested 16 times, the only symptoms I had were fatigue, and my Long Island accent always creeps up on me, even when I'm here in the land of the Queen's
English. Don't stop it. It's a Gatsby revival.
I was really tired, and I had terrible gnawing headaches that were just awful. And then I got tested, and I had no other symptoms other than at night I had a bit of a dry cough, but I had no fever and my oxygenation rate was fine. But anyway, so like aside from that, 2020 was really what was a great year for me intellectually, cerebrally. I mean, because again, just
your output was insane.
Every 3 weeks I was at the airport chasing art fairs, which was, it was just superfluous. And it was just, it became so kind of like, it was just fungible. Like, one, you couldn't tell what city you were in, what art you were looking at. It was just this constant kind of grind.
And you had thoughts about it at the time. I remember.
Yeah, but I have to. And then on another note, in 2018, the last time I saw you, I was with my son, who's passed away. And it was an issue. He was in Slade. He spoke so eloquently about art school. And yeah, I lost him to kind of issues that he kept utterly to himself and never expressed any kind of feelings that he was having, but he was having awful feelings and mental health issues, and he never expressed it to any of us. And it's been basically, I mean, it was, yeah, from something as awful as that, I'm trying to make some good come. He took his life, and it was just, he had everything in the world going for him, friends in every country, beautiful girlfriend, and was in the greatest painting school probably in the world, Slade. And yet he never had any mental issues. He never had anything that would be a sign, a representation of the fact that he was internally suffering. And yeah, so anyway, I've
Kenny, it's an interesting thing that you're talking about it. Well, and I'm really glad that
I've lectured about it. And I was crying in the School of Visual Arts when I gave a lecture that when I first moved back to New York 2 years ago, my oldest child, Adrian, was graduating School of Visual Arts. And then I called up the department and got a lecture there. And then I spoke about it for the first time. And the rates of suicide from people ages 15 to 24 is up 60% in the last 10 years. And I never in my childhood, I'm in my, let's say, late 50s, I never knew anyone that had experienced anything like that. And with my kids today, they know dozens of people that have either attempted to take their lives or have done. So, and I just remember, like, I mean, I'm getting chills.
No, me too.
I'm trying to keep.
I met your son once, and I was in shock.
I was so proud of Kai, the way he performed and spoke to you so eloquently, zero preparation, spoke about the ins and outs of art school and his experiences. And then we went and had a coffee afterward. And I just thought it was such a great experience. And I was just brimming with hope, because together as a family, we all make art in the family, and we've done exhibitions together in Shanghai, Los Angeles, London, New York, and now in Switzerland again, and there were no signs, zero signs. So anyway, I just think, like, by me talk, it's such a kind of
invisible.
It's invisible, but there's also a stigma that's associated with such a thing where, like, I mean, I still feel so responsible. And yeah, there's just, like, in society as a whole, people look askance at someone, a families that have experienced such a thing. You feel remorse, you feel guilty, you feel responsible. And I think that other people look at you and turn their head sideways and think, like, what kind of horrible person are you that you could have experienced something like that in your life? And I just think, since I've been teaching about it and talking about it in my writing, and I've had people, just yesterday, somebody spoke to me and said they were contemplating a similar act. And just by me being, I mean, I just think we need to talk about things that are uncomfortable, and it's far from easy. But again, I'm trying to take something that, I mean, there was a period where I didn't think I can, if I didn't have other children, I probably wouldn't be sitting here talking to you. Because, and I don't want to get
No, 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 it's exactly what I thought as well. I thought, you have three other kids.
And that's the only thing that's, and not only that, but then I had another, a child who had some drinking and drug issues, and I stopped drinking 2 years ago for the sake of him. And then when I lost Kai, I was just kind of habitually smoking marijuana, and I completely stopped. I just couldn't even look at it anymore. And when I stopped, it was like a veil had been lifted off of my head, and I just felt like, you get into these cycles, especially in the art world. You're constantly going out and socializing, and drinking is not just habitual, but it's de rigueur. You just think that.
That's right.
You don't
you
even
do.
Question it. You no. don't think about it. And it's like, I'm very obsessive compulsive, and it's like, the glass fills, the hand goes up. The glass
That's
gets
right.
refilled, the hand goes up.
And it's just part of the conversation around the
part
art
of
world.
The culture, yeah. Not just in the art world, it's in every world.
That's right.
And the shocking thing was that it was such a revelation, because it's such a stupid cliche that to be creative, you have to get fucked up. And I wrote one article completely blacked out. I never wrote without some level of imbibing red wine, institutional amounts often.
It's encouraged. Smoking. It was encouraged.
And then when I stopped, I mean, like you said, this is like, it took a year just for my brain, the swelling to go down and to regain some degree of sobriety. And I don't go to programs. I don't preach what other people should do. A lot of people are very comfortable dealing with moderation in their life in all respects. And I don't happen to be one of them.
I just said that. I haven't learned how to moderate myself with Netflix. I also don't drink anymore. I stopped the whole thing too. Yeah. And it's, thank God we have the art world for it, because right. you yeah. can approach it in an addictive
yes. I've learned
manner
to redirect
as well.
I've learned to redirect this. I mean, I'm not the smartest cookie, but I work hard and I am motivated, and art saved my life. And as a result, I'm trying to help other people. I teach nonstop. My teaching has mushroomed. My writing has gotten much better. And I make art as well as another 12 different things. And I think that my artwork, at least my productivity has exploded. And again, like, I'm not preaching. I'm not in a cult. I'm not in, you know, there are different programs that help different people that they swear by. Some of it is a little bit extreme, where people think you can only recover if you follow this route. I'm not going to name any names like Alcoholics Anonymous or anything like that.
Yeah, no.
But I really don't care. It's whatever works for anybody.
And that's right.
I really have been, like, in a sense, rejuvenated, reinvented, and saved from art. And yeah. So again, like, I've taken, like, you mentioned Inigo Philbrick, and he was someone who stole $50 million from unsuspecting people in the art world, and many of his victims were very wealthy, or companies like finance companies. Some of the companies themselves, basically, he was not only just an instance of greed and a compulsion of his own, which was certainly exacerbated by his drinking and drug taking and his arrogance, but he was a super knowledgeable, funny, sympathetic character before he went awry. But the fact is, I wrote an article. I mean, he basically stole money from some very close friends of mine, and he stole between $1.5 and $2 million from me, which was catastrophic and still is catastrophic. But it wouldn't have bothered me because we made money in the past when he was doing legitimate business. And that's just part of life. But anyway, when he stole money from my friends, I was so incensed and hurt and mortified that I wrote a tell-all article for New York Magazine a year ago. No, it last March. And then in June, it was reprinted in the Times here in the UK in the Saturday magazine.
That's right.
And then I had 10 offers for movies and documentaries. And I thought, I don't want to have my name in the credits. I don't need to be. I'm not a movie person. I am a one-trick pony. I do art 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. I teach all the time. Every day I get, because I'm very frank and very transparent, which is quite unusual trait in the art world.
That's right, too.
I always tell people, like, look, I'm here. I've been doing this for 30 years. I've gained a certain amount of knowledge. And if you have any questions and if I can help in any way, I feel it's my, I'm compelled to help people because I just like to. And I like to, no one listens to me in my family. So I appreciate you sitting across, standing across from me. And I appreciate the audience and having, you know, I just think if any, if I have anything worth saying and if I can help, it's my duty. So I constantly tell people, if I, every time I lecture, and I've been lecturing more the past 6 months than ever before, I just tell people, contact me, DM me. I respond to every single message within 24 hours. And if there's any which way I can help anyone, it's my pleasure.
That's how I met you. I'd heard about you for years, and that's how I met you. I DM'd you. And I get, actually, after you've been on my show, I get young artists going, can you ask Kenny? I'm like, what? Ask him. He's accessible.
I mean, you could just DM me on Instagram is my name, and yeah. I'm not promoting anything, and I'm not making any money. In fact, like when I did an auction, only I could, I'm so unprofessional when it comes to making money. So I had an auction, and I managed to
the hoarder.
Yeah, I hate
Sotheby's.
The word disruption or just being a plain pain in the ass, which is basically should be on my business card. But I did an auction, and in a way, it was like not sabotaging, but approaching an auction house in an entirely different fashion.
Right.
Which was no reserves, any price would do. Things sold for $300. The most expensive lot was like $200,000. That was another sculpture that I lost money on.
What piece was it?
It was a Ken Price is a ceramicist right. from Los Angeles who's died. It was a piece I actually bought at auction. I rarely do. But in any event, the craziest thing was there was a homeless artist at Sotheby's who made installations, and all the locals knew about him when he was alive. And I included him in many group exhibitions. Curtis Cuffey, he was wildly talented. And the thing
London or New York?
He was New York. And in the auction, I had art from people that don't make art anymore. I had a car. I had a sculpture that I made in the form of jewelry. And there was furniture, and there was places to sit down. And the craziest thing was,
and you were on site talking to people.
I kept office. So I
know.
It's, I love art, and I think, so back to like, I mean, I'm going to kind of free associate here.
Good.
But
I'm up for it.
When Indigo stole all my money, I basically, and all these documentary companies and movie companies came to me, I thought long and hard about a documentary, and I realized, why on earth would I devote 6 months of my life and talk about bad behavior.
Correct.
And the art world is a bell's curve of morality.
That's right.
And integrity and ethics. And
most people said, honestly, about the Ennio Philbrick thing, while you're thinking what you're going to say next, most people said it was probably one or two deals that went wrong.
No,
it was. And the next thing.
Yeah, but it must. No, he was bad. He turned bad. He stole, like, literally one company he borrowed $15 million from, and he collateralized the loan with five paintings, but he kept possession of the paintings. Then he went to another company and borrowed $15 million from them, and he used the same collateral for the first loan, for the second loan. So then he had $30 million. Then he borrowed more money and sold art that he didn't own. I mean, I'm such a bad art dealer. When I do deal, I can't sell art once. And he sold the same piece of art five times. So you have to take hats off to him. But anyway, so I approached one producer and I said, look, I'll do a film with you because you, and this one producer had gone to art school and he was sympathetic to the arts. So again, like people say the art world is unregulated and a cesspool of corruption, which I may have said myself at the Hay Festival when I was giving a talk. And it is, but it's no different from any other sector, whether it's there are doctors that are bad. In fact, there was a heart surgeon that stole millions from a foundation that was meant to enable children to get heart surgery. And he took all the money that he embezzled and bought art. And in a cynical, nasty, funny way, I refer to him as the best art collector in the world because he just had to have it so desperately that, I mean, okay, so that's a little bit too facetious. But the fact is,
It talks to the need.
I was able to sit, like, the art world is no more or less corrupt than, like, look at Goldman Sachs, the most famous investment bank, and there is worse than anybody.
Or pharmaceuticals.
Pharmaceutical companies, yeah. Increasing prices,
rent,
medications,
and rates.
Everything.
Realtors.
At the same
it.
Time, art gives me hope and fills me with passion and love. It has not changed since the first, I mean, I was very late coming to art. And the fact that I didn't know that a commercial art world and art market existed till I was nearly 27, I had no idea that art was bought or sold. I thought naively, I call myself an idiot savant, but I thought that art went from the studio into a museum. And it was not until I was procrastinating between jobs that I stumbled into Sotheby's when they were selling Andy Warhol's estate. And I was not particularly interested in his art, but I went there just to kill time. And they were gearing up for an auction. All the art I had seen in the museum was being sold, and I didn't even know art could be sold. And there was Andy Warhol.
You were a finance guy at the time. Tell me.
I told you, when it comes to money, money doesn't sit with me terribly well. I spend it. If I make $5, I spend $7.
What were you doing at the time?
I went to law school just to hide because I had a philosophy degree.
Yeah.
I went to law school with zero intent to practice. I told my family and my employers that I was in night school, but there was no night school. And then I worked on the stock exchange floor in New York City. I worked as a writer for law firms. And I ended up passing out my resume to 100 doors in the garment district. I wanted to do something creative and entrepreneurial, but I didn't know you could make art for a living.
Until you stumble into this Warhol exhibition,
right.
Which
so
is part
then,
of living in New York.
Right.
You
well,
see things.
Yeah, exactly.
You know?
There's so many galleries there. And
yeah.
It's so dense. With
and
culture.
Cities being open.
And then I went into fashion before that because that was a business that had to do with creativity. And I was like Willie Loman carrying ginormous suitcases around the East Coast of America selling neckwear, fanning the ties out on a table and selling them. And the craziest thing, because my life is so improbable, I was allergic to silk the whole time. So I had to like fan out the ties, try to sell $1,200 of ties to a committee of 15 people to spend $1,000.
All then good I had training.
To go, and then
all
I had to
training.
Wash my hands really fast so I didn't get hives all over my face. And every time I have such a pathological fear of getting lost in the worst sense of direction, I couldn't even find my way with a sat nav by foot from where I parked my little car to get here. That's why you saw me going to and fro.
I knew it, though. I told you, didn't I? I'm like, he's like me.
Studio.
He's going to get lost.
Me.
But I'm the same. I could tell you things that are... So back to this
Well, anyway, I'm just trying to say
into.
That the art world... Like, I'll actually circle back to where we started.
Oh, so many things I need to say as well.
Well, this has been an unprecedented year of business closures, human tragedy, loss of life. I mean, London is locked down. We're here just because we're allowed to work. But stores are closed. Restaurants are closed. People are losing money hand over foot and everyone is struggling. Nevertheless, life has to go on
right.
Because we're here and we're living.
That's right.
And art goes on because people make art the same way they go to sleep and eat and go to the bathroom, as I said before.
And I agree.
And anyway, so you just have to figure out what to do and to make the best in trying difficult times.
So you're working with young artists. What is the sense they have at the moment? They didn't get their grad shows. I don't know where their creativity's at, how they're feeling about their relationships with online, how they're... Where are young artists
well, that's a really
with
great,
right now?
A great question. And... I mean, I always like, there was a, when I studied law, there was a case, this is just random, but there was a law case and the issue was the illegality of extreme pornography in the United States in the 50s. And one of the Supreme Court justices was writing his opinion and he said, I can't explain in my writing what pornography is that is the kind that they were trying to legislate against. But I know it when I see it. And it's like, I'm getting chills just talking about all these issues. And like, just today, I had a DM, a direct message on Instagram, which has absolutely revolutionized the art world and democratized it and broken down so many hierarchies. But I had a message like, everybody wants to know, how can they survive as an art maker, as a content producer in the visual arts and various other art forms? What can they do to survive? And I say, just do not even think about trying to send your work to a gallery for representation or for promotion or for help, because galleries in the small to mid-sized level are, for the first time, there's been rhetoric for decades about how these galleries have a difficult time and they're suffering, but now they truly are suffering, as everybody is. So this is no time to try to approach galleries for some sort of commercial assistance.
They can't help you.
They can't help you.
They can't help you right now.
How could you start a market for an artist that has no exposure when there's no galleries that are even open today?
And so what do you suggest they do?
So we're really lucky, because I'm so old. I could tell you, like, when hamburgers used to cost 5 cents, and I could say that when I started in the art world in the late 80s, I'm not 80, you had to send a photographic representation of the work that you were doing to be seen by another human being. There was no other way to convey.
Do you remember the slides?
Yeah, there was a sheet. There was a sheet that contained 20 photographic slides that were about 1 inch square, and you would have to hold it up to the sun or to the light and see
them.
Unless
they had a light table, and then you'd get a glass.
Right, but then most galleries would receive unsolicited material and throw it in the garbage without even opening it. There was only one gallery, besides my independent curating at the time, a gallery with a man called Hudson. He had one name, and his gallery was called Feature, and he was extraordinary. And he would actually take out a red pen and critique every submission that was sent to him, and it was a beautiful, extraordinary quality. But again, like, back to the whole Indigo thing, back to what we're talking about, there's a lot of great things that are happening and a lot of great initiatives online. So now, it used to be so difficult. Access is one of the most difficult aspects of the art world. How do you get access to collectors? How do you get access to, you know, to the art world, to get
Correct.
A foot into the commercial dissemination of artwork?
Yeah.
And the fact is, you have to, the do-it-yourself mentality, which is how I started.
Yeah.
And it's funny, because when I went, I used to do hit-and-run shows before the term pop-up existed, where I would...
Hit-and-run's much better.
I would beg, borrow, and steal to get an uninhabited commercial storefront, and I would trade whatever art I had accumulated, and I would just take over a space temporarily, stage a show, keep the doors wide open no matter what the season was, and steal a mailing list from a gallery and just try to get a critical response and some exposure and some funds for emerging artists. And it's funny, because when I did the auction, fast forward 30 years, when I had the auction at Sotheby's, it was the first time in 276 years that someone who sold work was sitting on the floor trying to sell their own shit.
So interesting.
It's never happened before. And I literally had a desk that said, Kenny Schachter, the hoarder.
That's right.
And the fact was, there was somebody who worked at Sotheby's in New York. He's head of online sales, which has become the only way that now auction houses are doing hundreds of millions of dollars, if not billions, online. So because I did the first hoarder sale last December, so I've done two, Hoarder 1 last December and a year later.
You had one around here.
I had one in London because I was moving. That's when I got the idea. And there was a great guy called Darren Leake, and he's been fired from Sotheby's because he was so artistic and he wasn't as commercial as they might have liked. But anyway, that went really well. And then I did it again. And I met this guy called Harrison Tenzer, who's head of online sales at Sotheby's. And the first thing he said to me was, why don't you make some fake satirical ads poking fun at Sotheby's? And I thought, you know what? This is going to work.
He said that.
He said that. And I realized,
that's
of course,
what we need, the fun again.
Yes. He was an artist. He is an artist on the side.
Yeah.
And his mentality was so fantastic and so creative and so against the grain that I kept office hours. And it ended up to be the same feeling as when I had a show in 1990. There was people coming in off the street. There were great people that came in. And there were some crazy motherfuckers that scared the shit out of me.
They always are
towards the end. And I was petrified. But that's what you do when you're like a hood ornament on a car. Just the doors are open and anybody can come
in.
That
was the fun of it.
It was fun, but it did get a little bit scary.
Yeah,
but
we'll sell Banksy and then find out the weirdos that come out.
You know what? I have to say, like, I like Banksy. I think he's funny. And I think humor is such an important... I mean, there were certain street artists that I abhor. I won't say the name of
I
one.
I think I know. I think His we name all is know. Cause.
I won't tell you the cause of my dismay, but I don't care what you do. I don't care, like, if you're the biggest, I mean, I always say I'm an asshole, but I'm not a CU and fill in the last letter.
Yeah.
Because I have good, I'm well-intended, but I could be a little bit naughty and problematic. And,
but that's good.
Yeah. So
being
I just
provocative.
Like, I like to make my life interesting and the life interesting for other people. So anyway,
I know. How did we do it? We have 5 minutes left of the show.
I've done a lot of online shows.
Yes.
So I use Instagram. I used Instagram to promote my auction. 50% of the buyers had never been to Sotheby's.
That's
never
great.
Bought anything.
That's great.
And it's funny because I did it because Sotheby's does all the logistics. My attention span is 3 minutes.
Weren't they under 42, your buyers, your particular
they were all
buyers?
Young, yes.
Yeah,
and
that's
is,
really
like,
interesting, too.
I used
too.
Instagram to promote the show.
Right.
And people, it's funny because Sotheby's does the packing, the shipping, the chasing, the money, all the shit that I don't have the attention span for. It's amazing. But then because I was so open about my stuff being sold in this context, which was very unorthodox because I'm not the most professional. And then all the people that bought stuff started to get in touch with me, oftentimes asking me questions, the kind of questions that I was trying to get run away from by having Sotheby's do all the dirty work. But people are asking me, like, what's the history of the piece? What does it mean? When was it first shown? What does the artist think about it? So in a way, it like, but anyway, back to
which is great. You want them having those conversations.
I tell artists, if I can impart any advice to anyone, it's just make your Instagram site focused. Don't make it only about art because that's boring, but lighten up on the dogs and the food.
Yeah.
And just reach out by direct message to anyone who's ever crossed your mind that you think could have a similar sensibility or may be able to help you. Don't be shy. I fail every day of my life. I'm going to fail later today, but I never stop trying. And there's so many, tragically, so many companies have gone out of business. So negotiate with the landlord to take over a space, trade art, get a space for free. Do shows when the world slowly begins to reopen again. And in the meantime, promote the shit out of your stuff on Instagram and just don't be shy about it. Put things for sale for $200, $300. That's how I meet loads of artists. So many people I've fallen deeply in love with professionally and personally, I've met through Instagram. And my kids have always said, like, what the fuck is wrong with you? All you do is go on Instagram 24 hours a day. But it's absolutely transformed my work method, my life, my relationships with people. And there really is such a thing. People say, oh, you're on the phone, you lose sense with people. It's a community of people, and I've met half of them in person. So don't discount it.
I agree.
And use it as a tool every day.
Especially now, aren't we lucky to have
it's
it? Imagine if we didn't. Imagine if we didn't.
I mean, sooner or later, it's going to be transplanted because Mark Zuckerberg and all those dickheads in the tech world are so greedy. So anyway, use it now. In 5 years, it's going to be another platform. But for now, it's the best and there's no alternative, zero.
In terms of artists that you're looking at the moment, and by the way, I'll just ask you now, if you're free on Tuesday, come back.
Sure?
We'll do a part two. I'm absolutely sure. We have a guest who's he's not coming in because you're the only one in the last year who's got the
if
rights
come
to come
back,
in.
You'll see me going to and back
but
and forth.
There's
and
a guy
I'll
called Dot Masters who's
him.
Taken over shops on High Street, Kensington. You and I can talk to him together.
Yeah.
But come
Let's
back in if you're
together.
If you're yeah. But who are you watching right now? I mean,
I watch every. There's a woman, Eva Berrison.
Yeah.
And an emerging. People think new art is young. It's such a misnomer. An emerging artist could be anywhere from 20 years old to 100 years old. And I met this artist
Nicely
without
put.
Knowing who she was, what she was. I wrote her a letter. I'm like, are you old, young, gay, straight, married? Do you have kids? I love the biographical facts. And she's 65 years old. She was her parents survived the Holocaust. She's Hungarian, lives in Vienna. And I just loved her work. Bought a few pieces for hundreds of dollars. That's it. And I put her in an art fair, I showed her online, and she's now gotten 3 international gallery shows, and I've sold 40 works, and I've changed her life, and she changed mine.
Brilliant. That's exactly what an art dealer should do.
I'm a facilitator.
That's a, Castelli kind of thing.
I suck
as a
art dealer.
We have 20 seconds, Kenny. Do you want to play some music to play us out?
I just want to say one thing.
What?
Thank
Go
you
on.
Very much.
It's an absolute
Thank you for
pleasure.
Having me, and I just thank you for letting me express myself so freely.
Please come back on Tuesday.
It.
We'll do a part two if you're available. There's so much I want to say about
you
that.
Didn't get a chance. Okay.
No, I just... I will get a chance, and I'm happy to interrupt. Thank you for listening to A Private View. Thank you, Kenny Schachter, for being here. Thank you, Korsh at Homie, for producing. I love the energy. Kenny, come back on Tuesday if you're free. And we'll put a podcast together on this. For now, goodbye.